Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Literary Studies. I am John Yargo, your host. Today's guest is Kimberly Ann Coles, who is professor of English at the University of Maryland. Her first book, Religion, Reform, and Women's Writing in Early Modern England, was published with Cambridge University Press in 2008. Her work has been supported by the John Kluge Center, the Warburg Institute, and the Folger Shakespeare Library. Today we are discussing bad humor, race, and religious essentialism in early modern England, which has recently been released by the University of Pennsylvania Press. As the introduction states, quote, "While there is nothing inevitable about how material bodies are understood in political space, the texts surveyed in this book reveal how bodies are written to accommodate political and economic interests. This is certainly not the only time that religion is racialized in Europe, but it is the episode in English history when Christianity becomes black and white." I am excited to welcome Kim to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by outlining the overall argument of bad humor. One of the lines you trace in this book is the entanglements of body and soul in early modern race thinking. Another line is the embeddedness of religion in the language of corporate difference, which is itself embedded in the language of humoral science.
Yeah, the thrust of the book is the particular pressures of English colonial endeavor in the late 16th, early 17th century that drive a change in how the connection between body and soul is understood and the extent to which it's calcified, I think is the best word for it. It's not unique. I mean, there's a long history. Geraldine Heng, Lindsay Kaplan, a number of medievalists, Cord Whitaker, a number of medievalists have exfoliated a very long history that articulates a relationship between black melancholy and wrong religion, that that marks religious others with the humor of black melancholy. The difference in the early modern period is the impossibility of conversion for certain religious others. What's unique in this period and what the force that drives this is that English colonial violence is largely directed against fellow Christians. And that is a change. Historically, that is not the case. Religious others meant religious and cultural others, not those who are of a different Christian sect or those who are converts. So that colonial violence becomes problematic when the people against whom it's directed are recognized as fellow Christians. And this unique historical moment when the targets of colonial activity are Irish Catholic, Spanish Catholic, converted Africans, it forces a reorientation of this connection between Black melancholy and wrong religion that marks fellow Christians as unable to convert. And of course, this flies in the face of Christian doctrine, but it calcifies, it makes a physiological reality that their religion is pagan, is wrong, is outside of Christianity, and is physiologically marked within them by a humoral imbalance. This is the narrative, you know, this is the story. So it's the unique convergence of this long-standing theory of bad humors with a historically contingent episode of colonial activity, whether it's clearing Ireland in order to plant Englishmen there, or trying to establish a labor pool in perpetuity, that initiates a physiological fact of paganism that's marked by Black melancholy, and that is prompts this convergence of religion and what passed for science in the period.
You work mostly with cultural documents like poetry, but I think one of the signal moments in the book is this 1667 Virginia statute that you discuss a little bit, in which this cultural idea gets enshrined in law. Could you tell us a little bit about that statute?
So the whole book tends toward the final analysis of early English slave practices and how ideas of religion become, or rather, the evolution of the idea that religion is heritable, and how it then gets, how it becomes an idea of such currency that it can be written into early English slave codes. And so notions, the chapter 5 exfoliates how English labor practices evolve over time. And you initially have a labor pool that doesn't rely on African labor. Jennifer Morgan writes about this quite a lot, that English settlers rarely turned first to Africa to fulfill their labor needs. But what becomes clear in Cromwell's practices is the idea that religion is an inherited trait, and that the Irish are not regarded as fellow Christians. And where this becomes clear is in practices like Morgan talks about 2,000 women from Ireland being sent to Jamaica for the as part of a rape program. And Cromwell writes, not Oliver, his son, Richard, writes about how the forcing of sex upon them might be somehow distasteful, but it will benefit the English public. He says, being so much for their own good and likely to be of great advantage to the public. He's writing this to John Thurlow, the Secretary of State during the Protectorate. And actually, it wasn't Richard, it's Henry. Henry Cromwell. But this fantasy that he imagines that Irish women can produce Christian children through a rape program where they service English soldiers imagines Christianity as something heritable. And that they will somehow be reformed in their progeny through their rape by Christian Englishmen. He has a similar fantasy of sending Irish children to the West Indies. That over time. He says it may be a means to make them Englishmen, I mean rather Christians. So there's some notion of conversion in humoral terms as it relates to the Irish. There's a fantasy, there's a racial fantasy that imagines Irish bodies becoming English. But the crucial feature of this fantasy is that they might. And as distasteful as it is to talk about rape programs, this is where partus sequitur ventrum, I argue, comes from. Because if obviously the introduction of what can be imagined at this time as Christian blood reforms the body of the progeny, the potential for, due to the rape programs of on plantations, the rape programs related to African women, you would have the same outcome where their progeny could become Christian. And so what gets written into law is their permanent paganism, their inherited heathenism. And that's what gets written into Virginia statutes in 1662, Maryland statutes in 1664, and the statutes that proceed from that moment, the guarantee that the progeny of Black women will remain in perpetual servitude because of the guarantee that the progeny of Black women will be permanently pagan and cannot, through baptism or conversion, become something else.
Throughout the book, I could see clearly this crisis among these early modern writers that you discuss. On the one hand, they wanted to appreciate human mutability, the possibility to convert or to change, and the shared communal identity of Christians. On the other hand, they could not resist embracing what you describe as the opportunistic fiction of race thinking that could personally enrich them and license the wider nation of England to pillage and steal from racialized people. How do you see that tension emerging in the period?
It's practically embodied in Spencer. It emerges I mean, Christian doctrine insists that conversion is possible. And as I said, you know, Lindsay Kaplan, Jerry Hang, medievalists and people who work on literature of the medieval and late medieval periods have noted this this fact of Black melancholy as marking religious others. But the difference lies in conversion. That and Hang and Whitaker and a number of other scholars have noticed how the subject of conversion whitens at the time of conversion. So whiteness as a characteristic of white Christianity precedes the early modern period. Whiteness as the index of Christianity precedes the early modern period. What happens in the early modern period is that when you're marking fellow Christians, their conversion has to be impossible. It has to be foreclosed by physiological facts. And those physiological facts become an excess of Black melancholy that doesn't permit conversion, or rather makes them permanently obdurate. And so, you know, you have the inheritance of, you know, a long-standing idea of wrong religion being rendered in terms of color, staining the nature of bad Christians or those who are outside of the Christian faith, and the white racial body as the guarantor of normalcy, of moral value, of European Christian identity. All of that is not of the period. It's the calcifying of it, the insistence that Blackness intrudes in the bodies of colonial subjects to such an extent that those subjects cannot become Christian. Now, with the Irish, what happens, and this is what I try to show in chapter 5, what happens over time is the exception that the introduction of Christian blood or English, the intrusion of the English upon the bodies of the Irish, can somehow make them Christian. That's really not conversion, right? But it does allow for Irish progeny that could be Christian. And this fantasy never opens up for Africans. And so this calcifying happens over time, I guess, is the short story of the long story that I'm telling. But it also it flies in the face of everything Christianity is supposed to believe. And in Spenser, in The Faerie Queen, what you notice is not just the humoral condition of those who are marked by error, and the blackness of those who are marked by religious error, but so frequently the descent from females, error herself, sort of spontaneously produces children who are themselves obdurate and erroneous in their ways, you know, streams out black blood. These kinds of, and you'll see Red Cross when he's reformed in the House of Holiness, that reform takes the form, of a humoral reformation. It is not conversion. It is a humoral purging that happens in that house that then allows him to come to charity and to come to Christian belief again. So while Spencer imagines a Christian corpus, he also imagines that that corpus can only be maintained in health if certain members are cut off. And that's how he licenses not only his exceptions, but his incredible violence against the Irish.
This also reminds me of your reading of Othello, which maybe we can discuss. You read that play as staging a collision between different value systems, you know, one in which Othello's inherited lineage and the value that that affords him against his kind of inherited corporate difference, as well as his paganism. Can you talk a little bit more about your reading of that play?
Yeah. I have to say, I'm certainly not the only one who's noticed this. Embry and Dadaboy has talked about Othello as a figure that cannot be reformed. Urvashi Chakravarti, Jane Degenert. There are a number of critics who've seen the link to conversion and embodiment in Othello, and seen ultimately his inability to convert as a signal difference of that character in Shakespeare. Where I develop it is in the descent of Othello's progeny, in understanding that it's not that Brabantio's notion of Othello as pagan, even in the face of, in the face of his conversion, Iago is a suspect character, but he nonetheless asserts that Othello has been baptized. And so there's little reason to disbelieve that, I think. But for Brabantio, if the marriage has passage free, bond slaves and pagans shall our statesmen be. And so this is a revision of older notions of heredity, because Othello is also noble. He is both noble and a practicing Christian. He says he fetches his life and being from men of royal siege. And we're told he's been baptized. In spite of this, Othello himself, just by his nature in Brabantio's characterization, is a natural pagan and slave. And not only that, is sure to produce bond slaves and pagans. And neither of these things fits within the ideology of hereditary blood or Christianity. So Brabantio's image is one of a state fallen to pagan influence. But the two crucial assumptions in his fantasy is that Othello remains pagan in spite of all evidence that he's a practicing Christian, and that he will produce pagan offspring. And so he's not only inured to the effects of baptism, all of his progeny are as well. And what I argue is that that's not only a unique historical moment, but that's also unique in Shakespeare. And I think not simply Brabantio's perspective, I think it's the perspective of the play. I think on a very real level, Othello is characterized as outside of Christian communion, or he would have had faith, literally, in Desdemona and Cassio, that he is naturally an unbeliever who cannot participate in the love that's offered by his friend and wife. And I think these ideas do underwrite the play and, in fact, are part of the colonial mindset of Shakespeare's time. In other words, he does more than record these colonial notions in his play. He helps to produce them. And at one point you said that I deal in literature. Part of why I do that throughout the book, deal in fiction, is because race obviously is itself a fiction. But one of its most persuasive vehicles is literature and culture. And when it's conveyed through Shakespeare, I mean, I think we no longer can see artists and particularly writers of this period as not producing the colonial mind that occupies it.
I'm interested in the evolution of the project. You discuss Elizabeth Carey's Tragedy of Miriam and Donne's Holy Sonnets, which are not usually read through the lens of critical race studies. In general, analyses of race thinking in the period focuses on drama, notwithstanding the great and important work of Kim Hall, Dennis Britton, and many others. But this book especially focuses on lyric poetry and other forms uniquely. How did you decide on this archive? Were there texts you considered taking up that didn't end up in the final book?
These arguments find you as much as you find them, you know. I'm not the first one at all to look at Carey's Miriam in terms of race. As you point out, Kim Hall, Margie Ferguson, Dimna Callahan. I think where I depart from those previous analyses is in looking at Carey's Miriam in terms of heredity and the heredity of, you know, sort of noticing how blood defines markers of nobility, but also markers of morality and defines the license of moral and political leaders. So Herod is darkened. Miriam gets whiter and whiter as the play goes on. And part of that is underwriting a real struggle for power between Miriam and Herod, and a genuine struggle for power that's outlined in Josephus between those two families. You know, that this is a political struggle. But what's notable in Miriam is how these differences are rendered in color and ascribed to moral differences. And so the first three chapters of the book, I mean, in the whole book is looking at discourse, right? But trying to understand, particularly if I'm trying to understand how these ideas get so current that they finally find their way into legal codes. One of the ways of sort of thinking about that is how discourse is circulating, but also imagining that discourse is available, but it's not always being pressed into the service of race. So you have a discourse in this period, both theological and medical, that can be politically exploited, particularly when a threat from a particular colonial subject is most acutely felt. But it isn't always exploited. And so I start, for that reason, the first three chapters start with works that are authored by Catholic converts in England proper, because those authors are actually less likely to deploy the terms of this discourse in the service of a racial episteme. And for this reason, you can, I hope, first view the discourse that is available and then how it gets appropriated, how it gets picked up, how it gets how it is put into the service of race at particular times when political and economic agendas collide with it. So the first three chapters try to do exactly that. The first half looks at a work authored by a Catholic convert, and the second half looks at a work that exploits that discourse and then tries to think about, okay, with Dunn, what is the traffic between body and soul? And how does this traffic permit the corruption of both? And then chapter two looks at Ben Jonson and The Mask of Blackness, which he wrote when he had converted to Catholicism for a queen who was a reputed Catholic convert. And tries to exfoliate how the melancholy soul shows its colors in the skin. And then chapter three tries to look at how bodily disorder and a degenerate soul can be passed off onto offspring. But in both, you know, in all three cases, the first text isn't doing that work, but it shows how available that discourse is. And then the second text shows how it gets exploited.
Two things I'd like to say. One is that I think that really foregrounds one of the things that I appreciated in this book, which is that you're always throwing into relief the material incentives that drive race formation. And the other thing is the structure of the chapters, which I came to think of as oscillative or metronomic in exactly the terms you're describing. There are these conceptual swings. For instance, the first chapter shifts from John Donne's Holy Sonnets to a Christopher Brooke poem on an indigenous revolt in North America. Donne sets out a set of racial ideas, and Brooks enlists them in a dangerous political project. How did you devise that narrative strategy for your chapters?
So, like I said, part of this was sort of thinking through, discourse that's available and then how and why. What are the terms under which it becomes exploited? What are the terms under which it changes? So Dunn and Brooke are lifelong friends. I mean, there's little question that they would have talked about ideas that are available in Dunn's Holy Sonnets, the traffic between body and soul, the potential for a damaged soul or the potential for the soul to corrupt the body and the body to corrupt the soul. Dunn's anxiety over being a convert. His sonnets are shot through with the anxiety that he might, because a former Catholic might not ascend to, he might not be saved. And this idea is worked out again and again, but it's worked out again and again in terms of flesh and blood. In the Holy Sonnets, in terms of a physiological fact that he seems unable to escape. And one of the things I try to map in that chapter is why would he believe something that crazy, right? But it's a crazy that occupies the period. And I trace it back to an early argument of Pietro Papanazzi that I think really does transform the thinking of the period. And it certainly transforms the natural history. It informs later notions of how the soul interacts with the body in really crucial texts like Philip Melanchthon's De Anima, texts that get referred to again and again as a resource for both theological and medical knowledge. So this, you know, I sort of use Dunn to work out the particular anxieties of a period that could imagine the soul offers corruption to the body and vice versa. I work those out or try to work them out in terms of the salvific imagination of Dunn. But these ideas you can see in his letters to Henry Goodyear are ideas he discusses with friends. And Christopher Brooke, living across the street from him, would have been unlikely to have not had those discussions with him as well. So when Brooke writes his poem on the occasion of the attack, the poem is called A Poem on the Late Massacre in Virginia. What it is actually is the Powhatan tribes attacking Jamestown because there was an expectation that they would leave and the indigenous people became cognizant of the fact that they were going nowhere. So they went to wipe them out and succeeded. But of course, this only brought, in 1622, this only brought more boats to Virginia. But what's interesting about Brooke's poem, which Casey Evans, I think, rightly qualifies as probably the most racist text of the period, is his assertion of not just the inhumanity of the indigenous people, but the extent to which this is humoral and the extent to which their bodies are just sort of hydraulic machines. Two lines, consider who these people are. I cannot call them men. No character of God in them. Souls drowned in flesh and blood. And that, I mean, honestly, that set me on to this whole project. When you're trying to imagine what that could possibly mean, a soul drowned in flesh and blood. In many ways, that sort of launched me into the project.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
In your chapter on Ben Jonson's Mask of Blackness, you bring the context of religious conversion to bear on Jonson's race thinking, and in particular the rumor that Queen Anne was a covert Catholic. You also track the determinative role of melancholy on one's spiritual and intellectual life in that play. Can you talk a little bit more about Jonson's Mask of Blackness and how it figures into your argument?
One of the things, Jonson has to be careful, obviously, because the Mask of Blackness and Molly Murray, proposed this years ago, that the mask of blackness is in some ways a pageant of obedience on the part of Anne for the benefit of her husband. She's quite clearly a convert by this time. She's a rumored convert. But the rumors are a pretty sure thing by this time. And this is a political problem throughout James's reign. And so the Mask of Blackness performs her promise to be reformed by her husband's superior moral, intellectual, and religious instruction, right? What I propose is that that the Mask of Blackness shows the extent to which black melancholy is an index of wrong religion. But the humoral terms that Johnson uses in the Mask of Blackness is an index of the currency of the idea, that black melancholy resides in those who are maddened to the point of atheism. The difference in Mask of Blackness is that the Ethiopian nymphs are able to convert because they seek the faith and because they allow themselves to be reformed, literally reformed, in the superior son of England. And of course, James, this becomes James, you know, he may not be a celestial light, but he is God's light on earth, to which they become subject by consent. And this is part of Anne's promise, part of Anne's performance. She may have black melancholy. She may have wrong religion. She will allow herself to be reformed by her husband. But the reform is, I argue, humoral. And while the reformation of the Ethiopian princesses is withheld by the end of the play, it's promised. And so, you know, we not only have the power of James's light, sciential, not celestial, his ability to purify the body to the point where it's in condition for grace. But you know, we have the promise of, but not the delivery of reformation. And of course, that makes total sense in terms of Anne's particular condition. So, you know, I say that Johnson allows for conversion, and that is different from what you see in Pamphylia to Amphilanthus, in Roth's Pamphylia to Amphilanthus, which really does describe religion in humoral terms and racializes its others. To some extent, I think Roth envies the outside place, and that's part of what I argue. But I use Sharon Patricia Holland's The Erotics of Racism to think through notions of home, of family, of cultural situatedness as colored and racialized. And I think I think Roth really does characterize the body in this, in these terms, that the situation of the body, either inside or outside particular cultural and moral frameworks, is colored.
I'd like to take a step back and just talk about writing practices. Are you a part of a writing group? How do you workshop your writing? Do you have standard tactics, like, I know reading out loud is something people do, or are there writers you try to emulate, or academic writers you admire?
Wow. Okay, that's an easy question. Okay, writing group, yes. Mira Kafantaris and Dorothy Kim and I participated in a writing group for over a year. And I do that with a lot of my friends at different times with different groups. What's interesting to me is that I write articles in those contexts. I mean, they're hugely important to have support like that, to have collaboration like that, to have, you know, the exchange of ideas. You know, there's so much in my work that comes from other people and the conversations that I'm able to have with them. But I can't write a book in the presence of others. I've got to have absolute quiet and absolute lack of distraction. And I'm not even sure why that is. It's something to do with the size, something to do with how the moving parts fit together and lock. It has something to do with the way you find an argument in a book. I never end up with the argument I think I'm going to end up with. And that has to do with each time you enter into a text and you work with it, it produces the argument as much as you do. You start following it as much as anything else. And so I think that the larger projects, there's a kind of architecture I need to get as I'm working, and I can't have the benefit of collaboration at those moments, right? But where I get the collaboration is, I mean, my work would never happen if it weren't for people like Urvashi Chakravarti, Dennis Britton, so many generous colleagues who read my work and tell me where I've gotten off on the wrong foot and give me feedback. You know, these are long-standing collaborative relationships that have just completely shaped who I am as a scholar. You know, I think we miss a lot how collaborative our work is. I mean, even in the absence of actual people with us, we're always collaborating with the ideas of others. Somehow this weird notion of the rarefied scholar, how we ever got there, I'm glad we're moving away from it, but it was always just a bad idea and completely fictitious, right? Our work is always a matter of collaboration, of exchange, of arguing, of taking ideas from people and investing your work with their insights. So that's just, you know, that gets activated in real time with real people as you're writing book chapters and spreading them around, which is why your acknowledgments end up being a mile long, right? But that's how I work. I write something and I send it off to a few people who give me feedback, and I write it, and yes, I impose a lot on others. That's how I do it. As far as writers I model or emulate, I'm not sure I can model, but I certainly aspire to, I mean, there are so many. Kim Hall comes up all the time, but she comes up all the time because she set the model so long ago, you know, 25 years ago, she really put the model in place. And the pursuit of that model has been a switchback course at best, in to my mind. But you know, there's I can't even name the number of people. I mean, I've named some of them in this conversation. I think the people I haven't named yet, Gitanjali Shahani, Jennifer Park, you know, Patricia Kimmy, but there are just so, Noemi Anjai. I mean, there are so many productive models out there. And but I think what I love about our work is how, when you start trafficking in ideas, just how excited you get by the ideas themselves, you know, how much that just gets you interested in things. I mean, that's how I work. I get interested in something, and then usually I do a collection on that thing, because then I can read what everyone else thinks about it. And then I get, you know, that takes me further. And I think that's how I think. I think through other people.
And I think that comes through in the book, the intellectual curiosity, the enthusiasm, the collaborative spirit. I wanted to revisit something you said, which was, sometimes you're surprised by the reading you end up making about a text. Is there an example in this book?
You're all over it. I mean, I never end up with the argument I think I'm going to have. And I honestly have to give credit to Ayanna Thompson for a lot of redirection. She's a wonderful friend, a wonderful collaborator, but part of what makes her wonderful is when you're being stupid, she doesn't tell you. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for that talent, right? For somebody sort of gently moving you away from a bad idea without making you feel foolish for thinking it, or a bad question without telling you it's a bad question. It's not a bad question. That's the point. It's always a good question. It just might be the wrong idea. And I think I had a lot of bad ideas and stupid questions at the start of this book, but I that's part of the process, as far as I can tell, is getting it wrong over and over until you get it right. And you just hope you have good collaborators who will gently steer you away, you know. And I think a lot of my friends have done that for me over the years in ways that have just been so helpful.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful way to frame it, I think. After finishing this book, what advice would you give a scholar that is setting out to engage issues of race in the pre-modern archive? What future directions do you think are most promising? And perhaps reflecting on teaching, I assume you've taught courses based in this material, in this project. What have you learned about framing it or designing a syllabus?
Future directions. If I were to imagine a future direction, I think it would be that race is always considered in everyone's research all the time. So that critical race studies it will always be a discipline unto itself, but if I were aspiring, it will never not be a consideration in people's research. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about before, where no writer no writer of this time should not be implicated in the colonial mind that is part of it, right? That every writer contributes to the production, the politics, the arrogance, the violence, the economic, the assumption of economic privilege of the period, the whiteness that gets produced. It's not hatched in a pod. It's in every work. And I think that's how I teach it. That is the way to teach it, to think through with students. Race is a fiction. Race is a potent fiction, but one that occupies texts in this period all the time. And we've been talking about this throughout, one that's really manufactured. Race is a fiction created to naturalize social arrangements of power that are already in the making or already in place, but it takes advantage of discourses already available. And you can see why. I mean, if you're going to persuade people of something, you want to make use of what they're already persuaded by, right? If they're already persuaded, for example, that body and soul are mutually informing and corrupting, you can use that to argue that the soul or the body's condition, I mean, you know, chicken and egg, but to argue that the soul's condition is permanently obdurate and evident in a reading of the body, right? That's one way, but you want to persuade them of the second thing, not the first, right? You want them to already be convinced of the first, right? And so race, and Jonathan Burton points this out, race just, it scavenges. It's this crow that picks up shiny things that work for the sewing together of a discourse out of materials that are already there. And so when I'm teaching, one of the things I sort of work with is talking them through race as a term and as a concept, as a fiction that changes under the pressures of economic and political agendas. So it will be different at different historical moments. And what is it making use of at this moment? You know, what discourses is it pressing into service here? And for what purpose? So I've got a class. We have these things called I courses, which are these massive classes of 75 freshmen who are supposed to be exposed to intellectual ideas in the course. And I've got one called Race and the Cultural Politics of Blood, a Historical Perspective. And it sort of walks them through different historical moments of fictions, rhetoric, politicians, protesters, pundits, and how these the notions of race change at different times in the service of different ideas. And then, you know, juxtaposing those writers. So, you know, Douglas is juxtaposed against Melville. Du Bois is juxtaposed against later rhetoric of Wallace or Goldwater. They end with arguing the case for reparations through Ta-Nehisi Coates's Atlantic article. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that when I teach, or going back to your idea of aspiration, I want critical race theory to be part of research all the time. And I want it to be part of the classroom experience all the time. Because I think for too long, we've tried to talk about these texts as aesthetic instead of political. We've tried to imagine texts as ever not political. And I think we not only do a disservice to our students, but to some extent, well, two things. To some extent, we make the class less interesting for them. But I think we also, if we don't admit the politics, the racism, the agenda in these works, we're not fooling them. We're only then denying what they themselves see in the texts.
That's such an important and urgent invitation for all of us, I think, as teachers and scholars. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Kim.
Thank you for having me. I always love talking to you, but this is a wonderful podcast, and I'm honored to be part of it.
Yes, we've only just begun to explore some of the fresh close readings in Bad Humor, and I really encourage all listeners to go out and engage with it themselves. Thanks.